everyone. This is Small Towns, Big Stories, and I'm your storyteller and host, Liz Carey. I want to say right up front, this is my first ever attempt at a podcast. I don't know what I'm doing, and I might even screw it up. It's a possibility. God knows things like that have happened before. But I've been a reporter for 25 years, and in the process of finding big stories and reporting on little stories, I found all of these stories in small town America that make up our collective history. So I'm not an expert at this. I'm not a huge historian. I'm not even a dedicated student of any particular period of American history. I'm just passionate about finding these stories that really give an idea of what America is made of, and are entertaining looks at the past. So, for the past 25 years, I've been a reporter, like I said, and I've written stories in towns in Kentucky, Ohio, and South Carolina, and now in North Carolina as well, and in Georgia. I'm a freelance writer now, and I have clients across the country, so I'm able to write about and talk to people all over the country and find out about their communities. Now, I've written about big stories, little stories, everything in between. I've written about Baptist ministers who have embezzled millions from their flock. I've written about a donkey who adopted an elementary school. I've written about women in their 60s who decided to get involved in a 1,000-kilometer horse race across the steppe of Mongolia, to a woman who left her job as a teacher to become a foster mother. So I've been able to be out there and talk to all these people and find these great stories, and I'm just so passionate about it, and I love it so much. Somehow along the way, I won like 30 awards for my writing and reporting, and now I have the absolute pleasure of being able to write whatever I want. So, in February, my first book was published. It was by Acadia Press and History Press. It's called Hidden History of Anderson County. By the way, it is available on Hidden Press or HistoryPress.com and Amazon.com. Not that that's a shameless plug or anything. At any rate, it's a collection of stories about the history of Anderson County, South Carolina, where I live now. When I moved here in 2007, I started hearing all these stories about Anderson County. Stories that happened, you know, during the Civil War, before the Civil War, during World War II. And I just thought, well, holy monkey pee, there is just no way these things can be true. And it turns out they are, which is proof positive that truth is stranger than fiction and much, much more entertaining. Anywho, so as I started to promote my book, I would go to do these book signings, and I would go wherever they told me to go. So I've been to farmers markets, and I've been to church basements, and I've been to the museum, and I've been to bookstores and chocolate stores, and just about anywhere that anybody would have me, I, you know, would show up and sign my book. At any rate, what I found was that I would invariably end up talking to people who came up, and they came to talk to me not just about the stories in the book, but they came to tell me their own stories. You know, stories about their community, stories about their family, stories about their friends, stories about the history of Anderson that they knew that was important to them that may not be important to anybody else. And what I learned was that everyone knows a story about their hometown. And it's not something that is blasted on the front pages of the history book or told in elementary school classes, but they're important to the people, and they may or may not be common knowledge, but it does give a good idea of the people and the history of a community. So I thought, you know, really, let's just do a podcast about that. And I hope that we'll start off in Anderson and eventually move on to other places that I've been able to talk to and go to and find out more about. So with all that being said, I'm hoping you'll join me here once a week as we talk about all the stories I've collected, good, bad, funny, macabre, and learn a little about the best part of this amazing country of ours and the small towns in the United States. I kind of see this as a conversation. Now, granted, I'm doing all the talking, but that is what I'm good at. But I hope you'll still take the time to talk to me. Email me at lizcarey@charter.net. Hit me up on Facebook at Liz Carey Writer. Follow me on Twitter at LizardSC. Even chat me up on Snapchat at LizCareySC. I'm really new to all of this, so I'm not sure how else I can get you to talk to me here, but I am sure that we will all figure it out along the way. So sit back, grab a cup of sweet tea and some cheese straws, and let's talk for a while here on Small Towns, Big Stories. So, I am a transplanted Southern Belle. I mean, I'm actually from the South, but down here in South Carolina, my Kentucky roots just don't exactly make me from the South at all. And because I moved here only 11 years ago, I will always be, quote, not from around here, unquote. I live in Anderson County, South Carolina. It is in the upstate of South Carolina, and it's what I like to say is 3 hours from everywhere. In about 3 hours, you can drive from Anderson to Atlanta, Charlotte, Knoxville, or Charleston. Okay, you have to be going pretty fast to hit Charleston in 3 hours. You have to pray there's no traffic in Columbia, but still, it can be done. We're just south of Greenville and just east of the Georgia border. And Anderson has this wonderfully rich history of farming and textiles and manufacturing and military engagement and wonderful, wonderful people. So Anderson was part of the Revolutionary War. It was part of the Civil War. It was part of the Industrial Revolution. It was part of the labor movement. It was part of the civil rights movement. And now it's even part of the automotive and aeronautical revolution in the South. There are just so many stories, past, present, and future, to tell here. So I thought, the other day, my husband was driving through Belton in Anderson County, and he noticed a sign that said, "Reenactment of Brown's Raid on Anderson." And I thought, that was pretty weird. Because if you know the story about Brown's Raid, it wasn't a particular stellar moment in Anderson's history. I mean, Anderson didn't fare too well in it, didn't fare too poorly in it, and it kind of shows, I don't know, the struggle that people went through in terms of good and bad, and good decisions and bad decisions, and It wasn't exactly a time of heroics, though, or of valiant efforts by the Confederate forces to protect the Promised Land. In fact, the defense of Anderson to protect itself against these raiding Union forces didn't involve a fight at all. And so I figured, since Brown's Raid started on May 1st, and it's April 29th, what better day or what better story to launch Small Towns, Big Stories with? So when you want to talk about Brown's Raiders, then you sort of want to set the scene first. And the scene is, it is September of 1864, and the Civil War is coming to an end. About that time, Sherman is making his march from Atlanta to Savannah, burning everything along the way. And that kind of was the modus operandi. We're just going to destroy everything so that they can't rebuild and you know, come after us again, that the rebels are held in place. Coincidentally, that's probably why those kinds of actions are why Confederate soldiers in the upstate really joined the fight. They didn't see it as some huge philosophical battle over states' rights or slavery or whatever. They called it rich man's war, poor man's fight. And what they saw it was is an invasion by the North into their farms and their homes. And, you know, they just wanted to protect their families. So here's Sherman tearing down everything and burning everything from Atlanta to Savannah. Gets into Savannah in December of 1864. Basically sends a, you know, Christmas card to President Lincoln. You know, Merry Christmas, I give you Savannah. And when Charleston, the wealthy landowners in Charleston, found out about what had happened to Savannah, they naturally just assumed that they were next. You know, it was a huge port city, but it was also, there was rice plantations and tea plantations all along the coast. And those plantation owners, because of the malaria, because of the mosquitoes, because of the heat, because of the humidity, during summers, they would leave the coast and they would come up to the upstate. So they had plantations up here, like Ashtabula and Woodburn, and they would come here and they would spend their summers to get away from all the icky conditions in coastal South Carolina. And yeah, that's a really technical term. But at any rate, so when they found out that Savannah was being had burned, they assumed that they were going to be targeted next, and they made plans to leave and go to the upstate. So, what do you do when you're a wealthy landowner and you're getting ready to leave your home during war to go somewhere else? Well, naturally, you send all of your booze. And that's exactly what happened. They went and sent all of their valuables up to the upstate. So one of the things that they did, they had Henry Garnier, who was a French wine purveyor. He sent all of the booze for all these wealthy wealthy landowners, and they sent it to upstate South Carolina in Anderson. They put it in Creighton's store, which was a grocery store, pharmacy type thing, right outside, right in downtown Anderson, right next to the courthouse. And when I say they sent their booze, I'm not just saying, you know, oh, they sent a couple of bottles of rum, or they sent them a couple of bottles of, you know, cheap house wine. It was between two and three thousand bottles of wine and Madeira and brandy and rum and port, all of these wonderful alcohols that at that time were considered or estimated to be worth between $100,000 and $200,000 in those dollars, which would put them over $1 million worth of booze right now. So they're protecting themselves, they're protecting their valuables, they send all of their stuff to Anderson, start to get ready to go. Sherman's on the march, the Civil War is winding down, and everyone is on edge. Now, while Sherman was marching to Savannah from Atlanta, a man named General George Stoneman was marching from Tennessee to South Carolina. He had about 1,900 Union troops riding through the hills of Tennessee on their way to destroy the South. Now, what his job was to initially go through Virginia and North Carolina to stop retreating Confederate troops going into the Blue Ridge Mountains. But he was notoriously slow to get started. So even though he got his orders about the same time as Sherman did, it took him until Sherman got to Savannah to get on the move. So by the time he set out on March 21st, Sherman had already pushed through Columbia from Savannah. But Stoneman's goal was to get to Virginia by March 28th. And on March 25th, he starts ordering his troops to ride through the night. The midnight rides, they were called. He just wanted to get to his destination on time. But because it's dark and the roads, as they were just treacherous, they got lost between Hampton, South Tennessee, and Boone, North Carolina. And I'm not saying about that, you know, his competence there, because even now, getting through that stretch of US 321 is still pretty dangerous. But anyway, he's got all of these guys on horseback, 1,900 men trying to get through the hills of Tennessee into North Carolina. Finally, he makes it to Boone and travels through North Carolina. He goes through Asheville, through Hendersonville, into South Carolina, through Spartanburg and Greenville. But by this time, his directives have changed. And this is where Stoneman's units and Brown's raiders sort of separate. Brown was, General Simeon Brown was one of Stoneman's men. And they sent him ahead, and his directives were find Confederate President Jefferson Davis, find the Confederate gold, bring them back, and let's put an end to the war. Okay, so it's like April. It's, you know, the end of April by now. By April 28th, some of Brown's men are south of Greenville, and they run across 9 cadets on their way to the Citadel. There's a little skirmish. It's not a big thing. I mean, it's 9 people, maybe 20 total, who are involved in this thing. And, you know, nobody gets hurt. One guy got shot in the hand, and he was a Union soldier. They were going to leave him for dead. The women there around Williamston and Piedmont begged the Union soldiers to let them take care of him, and they nursed him back to health, and eventually the man came back and married one of the Southern South Carolina women that had rescued him. But that's the Battle of Anderson, and every year here in Anderson, they celebrate it with reenactments. Anyway, fast forward, it's May 1st. So Brown's raiders are descending into Anderson in advance of Stoneman, and they're out to capture President Davis and the Confederate gold. Now, nobody in Anderson was really prepared for this. You know, it's May Day. They're out, you know, doing their May Day celebrations and picnics and stuff like that. They knew that there had been whispers for months that Union soldiers may be coming through. But there wasn't like a bunch of Confederate soldiers were massing there or there to protect them, which was pretty weird because that was where the Confederate treasury was located. For a short time, Anderson was the location of the Confederate treasury. There's a school, it was Johnson Female Seminary, that's up off of South Main Street, and it had been the Confederate treasury, where they were printing what were commonly known as the graybacks. Instead of being, you know, U.S. greenbacks, they were Confederate graybacks. They were worthless. There was nothing backing them. There was no Confederate treasury to speak of. But, you know, people still wanted them and they still used them because it was the money of the Confederacy. So here's Brown's troops and his raiders heading into Anderson, South Carolina, ready to grab the Confederate treasury and hopefully find President Davis at the same time. So, General Simeon Brown was originally an innkeeper from Michigan who had been appointed to his position by the governor of Michigan. He rose up to general within 3 years. He was quick and competent, but not known as a really strict disciplinarian. By this time, Stoneman's brigade, the whole huge unit, had grown substantially, and Brown was in charge of about 1,900 men. So they weren't known for being a pleasant group to deal with at all. And Brown basically, it said, turned a blind eye to it. They could do whatever they wanted. So these troops enter Anderson looking for Confederate gold and Jefferson Davis. The gold had been in Richmond and was rumored to be heading toward Abbeville as Jefferson Davis was trying to get to Abbeville safely to end the war. But they knew, Brown's raiders knew, that the Confederate treasury was there. So they ran in. They go and they break all of the printing plates. They take the paper that the money is printed on and throw it out into the streets. Now, at this time, you know, there wasn't a lot of paper around. People would write in the margins of letters and they would, you know, answer a letter by answering it on the back of the sheet. And so people were running into the streets to grab up this paper and take it home. And Emma Reed said in her diary, Emma Reed was one of Anderson's daughters who kept a diary of her observations of Anderson in the Civil War. She wrote in her diary that children, black and white, were running into the streets to grab up the paper. So here they are, you know, grabbing up paper that's supposedly graybacks to use it for whatever. Anyway, Brown's raiders destroy the treasury and do what they can to prevent the Confederacy from printing any more graybacks. Yay, Union. So now what they want is the Confederate gold. At this time, they go into the streets and they start finding people and they string them up by their thumbs and they start beating people and throwing them into the streets and, you know, doing whatever they can to find out where's the Confederate gold and where's President Davis. Things are getting pretty bad. Emma Reed wrote in her diary that, you know, people were whipped. People were taken advantage of. People were generally ill-treated, I guess you could say. It's a nice way to put it. And her dad, Judge J.P. Reed, got pretty upset. He goes to the town founders and the town fathers, and he says, look, if we resist, it's only going to get worse. We don't know where the Confederate treasury is. We don't know where President Davis is. Let's tell them where the wine is. So, Confederate gold is not in Anderson. Confederate president is not in Anderson. Judge Reed goes to Brown and says, listen, I know you all have had a hard time of it. Just wanted to let you know, there's wine in the basement of Creighton's store. Now let's think about this for a minute. Here's Brown's Raiders, 1,900 men that could end the Confederate War. Right then, right there, they could find the Confederate gold, they could find Confederate President Jefferson Davis, they could leave town, grab him, everything's done. Did they choose that? Heck no. They went to the basement. And apparently they got hammered. They're, you know, getting drunk and laying around in the street and basically, you know, drank themselves until they passed out. They passed out in the streets. They wake up the next morning and they're faced with the prospect of being found by General Stoneman, who's a much stricter disciplinarian and who doesn't deal well with things like that. So, get up first thing in the morning and they take off looking for the Confederate treasury, and Jefferson Davis. Now, at this time, when they had decided to invade the basement and grab the booze, Davis was like 30 miles away. He was in Abbeville. He would not have been that difficult to get. They could have ended it all. But instead, they opted for door number two. So, later on, May 2nd, Stoneman comes, much the same as Brown did with his men, and he comes in, same thing happens, running through, looking for the Confederate treasury, looking for President Jefferson Davis, trying to figure out what to do and where to go to find this man, beating people, stringing them up by their thumbs, doing whatever they can to get the people of Anderson to tell them where Davis and the Confederate gold is. So, J.P. Reed, Judge Reed, does the same thing with Stoneman. And he says, you know, we don't have Confederate gold, we don't have Confederate president, but we do have door number two, which is the booze down in Creighton's store. Now, Stoneman was a little bit more of a disciplinarian. So he goes down there, and knowing that his troops have had a hard time of it, he goes and allows them to have one canteen each of wine, which I'm sure happened. And then they're supposed to pour the rest out, which I'm also sure happened. At any rate, after that happens, not much bloodshed. No bloodshed at any rate. The guys have a little bit of liquor and, you know, finish their work there in Anderson. And this, consider this. Davis is still 30 miles away in Abbeville. Judge Reed has just bought him 2 days of safe travel time to get everything set up to hide the Confederate gold, to sign the papers that he needs to sign to end the Confederacy. He's given him a 2 days head start. So, eventually, Stoneman travels through Georgia, back into Greenville, and through the North Carolina, Tennessee, Georgia, and South Carolina, but Anderson was saved, all thanks to Judge Reed and to booze that he didn't own. No one has ever found the Confederate gold. Jefferson Davis later on signed papers to basically end the Confederacy in the Burt Stark House of Abbeville, South Carolina. The Burt Stark House is the birthplace of the Confederacy because it's where Davis signed the Articles of Secession, and it's also basically the death place of the Confederacy. At any rate, that's one of those more interesting big stories from a small town in upstate South Carolina. And that is our first episode of Small Towns, Big Stories. I'm your host and storyteller, Liz Carey, and I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I've enjoyed telling it to you. So, email me, call me, well, guess not call me, but, you know, follow me on social media, and I look forward to talking to you again next week for Small Towns, Big Stories.